What's up, founders, and welcome to the In Demand podcast, where we talk all about how to troubleshoot growth for your PLG SaaS. I'm your co-host, Asia Arangio, the CEO and founder of Demand Maven.
And I'm Kim Talarczyk, client services manager at Demand Maven, where we help SaaS companies reach their toughest growth milestones.
All right, Kim, let's get into it. Okay, so value decline. Value decline is one of those things where there probably is a more formal name for it, but I'm calling it value decline because that's the easiest way for me to communicate what it is. But basically, it's the concept of users come into your product to accomplish some jobs to be done. There's maybe some overarching jobs to be done, and there's smaller, more task-oriented types of like jobs to be done. And then from there, usually whenever people sign up for the product is probably really well formulated and designed to help them accomplish that first job. But then once the job is done, sometimes there are other jobs that pop up. So like, if you think about, maybe the job is I want to file my taxes. And you're like, yep, okay, I want to file my taxes. Help me, you know, prepare the data, help me get the paperwork ready to go. Help me, you know, do checks and balances on itemized deductions versus standardized deductions. And then it's like, okay, great. We've prepared the tax document for you. But the job is file my taxes. Another step in that process could be help me send it to the IRS, help me file for state versus federal, do like the easy file versus mailing it or whatever. And maybe your product does 80% of that. And maybe it doesn't do those last couple of like extra jobs or whatever. So that's normal in any product. That's super normal. It's very common. You can't build for every job. Like, you do have to be focused. But sometimes the value that a user gets from the product is vastly more expanded when you do start to address some of those other like additional jobs that pop up. And value decline is the process of actively choosing not to address other jobs. And the more time that passes, the less value ultimately that users get from it. So the value declines. And there are a number of forces that cause the value to decline. Sometimes it's just we're not continuing to expand the product in a way that accomplishes more jobs to be done. So that's one. Another one is market forces. AI is like the new shiny, amazing thing. Not saying that AI is going to be great at this. However, imagine if instead of you having to do everything, now an AI can populate all the information and populate all the data, giving it a certain number of forms or whatever. And it can accomplish maybe some of the other additional jobs like filing for you, accepting the refund. So imagine if TurboTax didn't enable you to also get your refund really easily, where like you integrate your bank account and the money automatically drops in. It's accepted by the IRS and processed by the IRS and processed by state, and you automatically can pay and like receive all of that. Market forces may force TurboTax. And there's actually a solid chance that TurboTax already uses AI and we just don't know about it. But imagine if market forces, like with AI being like the new shiny thing, it's probably gonna force like a TurboTax, for example, to think about how to leverage that to continue to provide more value, reduce the steps, reduce the friction, make it even easier to achieve the value. So market forces can actually impact how people experience the value of your product. And some of this is controllable and some of this is not. Another way to think about this is when the pandemic hit, when COVID happened, and any platform that offered online community or virtual meetings or anything that offered virtual community of any kind or connection of any kind suddenly saw a really big spike because no one can travel, no one can like go in the office. So if you were like a virtual meeting platform like Zoom, or if you were like a virtual events platform like Vito, all of a sudden, you know, you have a huge spike because market forces has changed how people experience value. When the pandemic subsides, market forces have now created value decline. And now all those products have to figure out other ways to provide value to people. you know, beyond what they're typically doing. So those are two. So again, there's deciding not to address other jobs to be done. There's also market forces. There are also competitor forces, or like competitive, and some would argue that this is market. And maybe what we can say is like, maybe there's market forces, but then there's like world forces, mm-hmm. like cultural phenomenons or whatever. But there are also competitors can actually make moves strategically that impact your perceived value that you may need to address. And that is technically part of the market, but it is worth, I think, calling out. Similarly, there are also like within market, there are integration or marketplace forces. Two companies get acquired by like a larger company, maybe also like an integration shuts down, or like the API cost of something 10x's and you can't afford it. Think about all the businesses, for example, that depended on Twitter's API. Like there's all kinds of like platform risk and like integration risk, et cetera, that can force a product's value to decline. So all that to say, like there are a few different types of forces that can dramatically change the context of how someone experiences your product and gets value out of it.
So what makes this value decline versus value status quo?
Yeah, decline specifically because you either see more churn, or you start to see like stagnancy in terms of long-term retention.
Okay.
So when I say more churn, that could be monthly revenue. It could also, you know, of course, be like long-term churn. Like maybe your net revenue retention a couple of years ago, it might have been like super awesome. It might have been like 100% at 12 months. And now maybe it's like 80 or 70% net revenue retention at 12 months. So that's like a very clear worsening of net revenue retention, long-term retention. That's one way you can see it. And then, of course, the other way is just simply you are hovering at like 60% or 70% net revenue retention at 12 months. And it doesn't get better. It doesn't really get worse. But you know that is like the thing that is preventing you from any like extra growth. And usually value decline shows up the most in NRR. Like that's the number one number. Now, whether it's declining or not versus like, you know, to your point, status quo, you know, obviously like you have to have that number for a while to actually be able to measure it and see like, did it decrease? Did it not? But 9 times out of 10, like I can look at NRR and I can just know, oh, okay, they're probably experiencing either some form of value decline, or it certainly could just be value status quo. But I would actually argue that value status quo, like if it's like just maintaining, that you are experiencing potentially value decline, but it's for very specific segments and types of users. And it just so happens that like on the flip side, you're retaining enough that it doesn't look that bad. So I would argue like stagnant NRR, especially if it's less than like 80% or even 70% at that 12-month mark, like you're probably experiencing value decline for some buckets of people. You're really experiencing it though if you're seeing increasing monthly revenue churn and also worsening net revenue retention. So that's how you really know you've got a problem. However, usually the founders and like the executive team, usually they know and they feel that, but they might not always know exactly how to articulate it. And that is where you really have to start at the center of the universe when it comes to a SaaS company, which is product. And I'm one of the things that I really love doing now, especially when we look at like product strategy work, but one of the things I absolutely love doing is really understanding what are the functional jobs to be done that people want to accomplish with the product, and then mapping out all of like the micro or like inner jobs to be done. So for example, if my overarching job is file my taxes, there are a number of functional steps that I have to go through in order to achieve that, whether the product is helping me do it or not. So everything from getting all of my documents together, uploading my documents, you know, making sure everything is correct. Like, do I have my W-2? Do I need my W-2 corrected? All of that work. All the way down to, I've got to figure out how to file this information. I've got to figure out how to prepare the form. I've got to figure out how to receive my refund or pay, because maybe I owe. There's a number of things that happen here. So yeah, the product may help with all of those steps, but also may not. It may not even be a part of the process. But what's critical is that you have a deep understanding of everything that the user goes through to accomplish that overarching job. And then you can actually highlight specific areas that are opportunities for your product. It's one of my favorite things to do. There are a couple of things that we call it, I think, internally. Some would consider it to be like a jobs map. Others would consider it to be like a value map. So what are all the different areas of value? And it's kind of like problem space versus solution space, where you get really deep into what the problem space is before you start solutioning. And anyway, this process is really valuable for understanding where your value might be declining and also what opportunities you have to improve the value and to have increasing value. Because customers who continually get increasing value from a product stay the longest, just bar none. Until, of course, one of those market forces happens, or competitor forces, or whatever. Until the forces that be change things dramatically and changes the context. But until then, your bet is basically on really deeply understanding the customer and how they want to use the product, and then where else you can go to create more value.
So how are you separating out kind of those external market forces versus what you can control?
It's a good question. I think in the early days, when I say early days, I'm talking like less than 10 million ARR, there is going to be a certain level of intelligence that you have about what's going on in the market. And 99% of it is just going to be out of your control. And I would argue, and I would wager, that that's actually true for most organizations. But the larger you get, the more you can make bets in more areas. So if you think AI, for example, is going to dramatically change the landscape of something, you put a little money towards that, but maybe you put a little bit of money towards the opposite. So like, this is where, you know, when you get into like large organizations and like enterprise, they have so much intelligence and they have so much, like when I say intelligence, I don't mean like they're smart. I mean like they have insights, data, they have information to help them hedge their bets. And like the larger you get, the more conservative you typically get about like how bullish you are in a particular direction versus not. And what we typically find is a lot of enterprise organizations, like larger ones at least, they tend to have eggs in every basket because it's too risky to have eggs in one basket. But when you're small, you don't have that luxury necessarily. And your smaller bets, while it is great to make and it's great to have that experience, may not necessarily have the same weight as if you were to just go all in on like one or two things. And that is kind of the game that you're playing in the early days. And that is normal. And there's a saying at this stage that's like, you know, better to have, you know, really firmly made a decision and committed to it than to have made no decision and not commit at all, because most CEOs are operating with 70% of the information that they actually need, or even sometimes 60% of the information that they need. They're not waiting until 99% because it's just not guaranteed, and there's always going to be things that they don't know. So I digress, but that's kind of how I'm thinking about it. And you know, again, when you're smaller, you don't have the luxury necessarily of placing a bunch of eggs in a bunch of different baskets. So you do kind of have to commit to certain paths, keeping in mind that like 99% of what happens is not in your control. However, what is in your control is how you react and like what you do. What choices now do you make? What opportunities do you take? I remember when the layoffs were happening, this was post COVID, like after like the big, you know, expansion in tech or whatever and VC and all that, and then the kind of low-key collapse. And like when tech companies were like laying off people like left and right, you know, the silver lining to that was, yeah, this sucks, but the silver lining is bootstrap founders and smaller companies are going to have more opportunity to hire incredible talent than they did before, you know, these large companies were like holding on to everyone and like hiring like crazy. So it's actually, in some ways, beneficial for the ecosystem to have the layoffs, because these are highly skilled people, and like they're going to get snapped up by companies who can afford to, you know, invest in them and keep them. And I believe it was Dharmesh from HubSpot who said, you know, this is actually kind of a blessing, because you know, if you're bootstrapped, you might not have had access to these people before. And now they're in the market looking for jobs. And that's kind of, in some ways, a blessing. Probably doesn't feel great for the person on the other end. Been there before. But like, that's like a way to think about it. So it's all about how you react is really what I'm trying to say. Again, like, none of this is going to be in your control necessarily, but what is in your control is what you do with that information. And something that Dharmesh said that has always stuck with me is, when you see other companies zigging, look for the zag. And does that work for you? Because, you know, if everyone else is zigging and it's actually smart to zig, zig. But if everyone else is zigging and it's smarter for you to zag, then do that. So that's something that I think about. And I don't think he used those exact words. I think he was a little bit more eloquent than me just now. But that's how I interpret his message in thinking that way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
This brings me to another topic that is also related to value decline. Typically, we see value decline. And there is always going to be a portion of value decline that is natural and normal. Because the reality is, you've got limited bandwidth, you've got limited resources, you're not ever going to be able to move as fast as someone's desires. So your customers are always going to want more. They're always going to have things that they want to see. That's usually not ever going to abate. Like desires and wishes don't decrease. They only expand. More is more is more in the eyes of a customer. And not always necessarily, literally, but like, most people like to feel like they're getting more for what they're paying. What's interesting about this, though, is so that's like a natural tension that happens in the business. But all of like the preventable value decline, and I don't even want to give this a number because I think it varies depending on the organization and what resources they have available to them, but a good portion of value decline is largely preventable. And usually what we see is, when we're experiencing a lot of value decline or stagnancy, meaning like people aren't really retaining longer than 12 months, or maybe you are stuck at like 70% NRR in 12 months or whatever, usually it's because we don't have a clear understanding of what people want to accomplish after they've achieved initial value with the product. We don't have a deep understanding of long-term life with our product. So what does living with your product at 2 and 3 years look like? And how is that different than the first 8 months of your product? So if you're a new customer, what does life look like for me in that first year? And then what does it look like for me at 3 years? And is it still important and relevant and valuable to me at that time? Mm-hmm. And there is no magic number to aspire towards here, but a lot of conventional wisdom says, you want to keep customers at least for 2 years for it to be worth it, worth the acquisition cost, worth the cost of business. If you're losing them in the first year, then you're probably either breaking even or losing money. So 2 years is like the minimum, but even better if it's even longer, and even better if they've expanded in that time. All that to say, though, so it's usually, again, because we don't quite understand all the things that they want to accomplish. The second thing is, we don't quite understand what long-term life looks like with our product. And the third thing, and no tea, no shade, but this is for anyone who's feeling this way. But the third thing is, sometimes it's us blocking our own success because, and I think this is very common for bootstrap founders, especially, and I'm talking directly to you if this has ever been you, but if you're a technical founder who's ever worked at like a big corporation, and there were like thousands of developers, and you have this deep, innate fear of building something huge and fundamentally broken. Think about like the worst enterprise product you've ever known or ever seen. And part of your founder journey was leaving behind that big, giant enterprise corporate life and leaving behind all of the dramas and woes of bad product building and bad engineering and like just completely dysfunctional corporate entities. And you went and you go out and you build your own SaaS. And in deep in your soul and your heart, you're like, I will never build anything that bloated ever. But the problem with this is, not only do you block your own blessings, like literally, the problem with this is that you're comparing you and maybe your small team to an organization with like layers upon dozens of layers of management, hundreds, if not thousands of employees, and probably more money than God and like Jeff Bezos and, you know, all the others combined. And that's sad to me because that's like going from zero to a million. Like, you're not even going from zero to one. You're going from like zero to like 20 bajillion, which is extreme. And what it does is it literally prevents you from investing in the things that you need to build a more successful business, to be a happier founder, because it's not all you all the time. Unless, of course, you love that. And, you know, if that's you, fine. Live your life. But then don't be frustrated later if you don't grow as fast, because the reality is that your customers are experiencing value decline because you won't hire the extra developer or you won't hire the extra product manager who could like run laps around the work that you do. You know what I mean? Like, and again, I'm not saying that to be shady. I'm just saying that because I see it a lot where this is so common. I'll talk to a technical founder. They want to get to 1 million. They want to get to 10 million. They want to get to some number, but they've got like a single developer and they're the PM and they have no other resources, maybe a support person, maybe like three support people actually, because like, you know, it takes a special soul to do support. But the reason why they won't hire anybody else is because they're like, oh, I don't want to be bloated. I don't want to build a product. I don't want to be like, you know, big enterprise 10,000 employee corporation. And if that's you, I'm going to hold your hand when I say this. You are not at risk for that. That's not a risk. That's realistic for you. Because you don't have Amazon Jeff Bezos money.
Let it go.
That's not ever going to happen. And the reason why is because you can't hire 5,000 developers. You know what I mean? Hire the one or two and sleep at night better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you have some trauma, see a therapist.
But that's the third reason. That's what blocks people. And
yeah,
it has to be said aloud. You hiring 10 developers wouldn't give you a bloated, traumatic product. It wouldn't.
Yeah.
You are not at risk for that. And if that is a deep fear that you have, the meme that just popped up, because I'm chronically online, but it's the Michael Jordan, like, get some help. Stop it. Get some help. But seriously, I'm going to hold everyone's hand when I say this, but like, you hiring that extra developer or two, that's not going to make a bloated product. It's just not. It's actually probably going to make it better for everyone involved, including yourself. Will there be some initial, you know, friction at first, you know, especially if you're not ready to let it go or ready to pass it on? Absolutely. Like, will it be difficult at first? Absolutely. Like, it's going to take 6 months for that new developer, engineer, or architect or whatever to get on board and really understand everything and like really provide value and like really get going. But if the reason why you are holding on to not hiring another person is because you're afraid of that, you're only slowing down your own growth. Like, especially if you want to grow. If you don't want to grow, if you like doing this, if it's more lifestyle for you, do you. This message is not for you. This message is for people who, like, they want to grow their business, but they're terrified of expanding development and product. Despite the fact that they have clear signs that people aren't sticking around long enough to achieve continued value because we're not building enough or expanding enough or whatever. And maybe your vision is to not build or expand. But again, if that's the case, we do have to temper our expectations. It's certainly possible to run a very happy, healthy, successful business. But maybe it doesn't get to 5 million. Maybe it doesn't get to 10. Maybe it doesn't get, you know, whatever number. But if you do have those aspirations, you do have to look at how your development team is structured. And if it's just you and one other dude and you're hoping to get to 10, you know, in a few years, like, you might want to realign your expectations or hire a lot of people. But all that to say, so I can't tell you how many times we come across like contradictory dreams and aspirations. That's definitely a big one. That comes up a lot. And I admire it because, you know, I very much believe like a bootstrap founder can do literally whatever they want, especially if they're profitable. If you're a bootstrapper, do whatever you want. However, if growth is something that you want, but you don't have a very well-staffed engineering team, you might be disappointed. But also, if what's holding you back from that is fear of having a bloated product, it will literally, it's not ever going to happen. Like, you would have to have dozens and dozens of engineers for that to be a problem. So anyway, and I know that sounds crazy, but I have advised, coached, and worked with hundreds of you. And there is a common theme and possibly also a common group therapy session that everyone needs to go to about this. Because it just seems like, you know, these big giant corporations like scar developers literally. And then they go and they create businesses and they're like, they're still living in the past and not in the reality that they're currently in. But anyway, I'll let that one go. But I'll pause here.
Are you sure you're done?
I'm off my soapbox. I just needed to get that one out.
Yeah.
It does impact people. It like you can I mean, we've talked to dozens of founders like in this situation, and you know, it doesn't matter how much I say it in some ways, but clearly there's this like mental blocker for them that there's a fear, and 99% of the time that fear is not warranted. It's just not like you're afraid of something else. Like you're afraid of success, actually. Fear of success is a bitch. It's an MF like no other, but that is definitely fear of success. You're basically afraid of it working and like needing to hire a person.
Right. And the weird part is that's the motivator to start the business was right. And
right.
But then it needs to stop there. And
yeah. Totally.
Yeah. All right. So those are going back.
Yeah. I was going to go back to the other two. So, you know, the third is largely self-imposed. Yeah. But the first two, usually it's because of a lack of process. Like we don't have the best process for really understanding user desires and user needs. And potentially, not always, but potentially if that aligns with our product vision, but generally speaking, especially if we're bootstrapped, there's the world is your oyster when you're bootstrapped in a few ways, not always, but the flexibility that you have as a bootstrap founder to expand your brand, to expand your mission, to adjust your vision. You don't have a VC or a board that you have to report to normally. You can kind of build and do whatever you want. And for some, that's scary as hell. And for others, that's like the best thing ever. And that's, you know, why you do what you do. But the other two, though, so again, like not really fully understanding the jobs and also to like not understanding long-term life with a product and like what are the other things that pop up. Usually we don't have a good enough process for validating our roadmap, validating even like the requirements for the features that we're thinking of. And there are some businesses where there are no new features. It's mostly quality of life improvements. But the quality of life improvements maybe aren't well validated or understood. So for example, there is a product that I know they don't really have like a roadmap. Like it's really more like they have a platform. It's not quite like an all-in-one, but it's similar. Like it's kind of like an all-in-one type positioning. They have a lot of different features. They do a lot of different things, but their roadmap is primarily, oh, we gotta tweak this one feature to enable this to help this type of customer. But they don't necessarily focus on improving the experience of using that feature. So a lot of it's like, we're gonna make quality of life improvements, but not from like a UX or experience perspective. It's gonna be more like, you know, it's more like turning knobs and like pressing buttons and like turning dials type approach. They don't ever launch anything new. It's just, oh, we've made improvements, or we fixed bugs. It's lots of bug squashing. I should put it more like that. It's either bug squashing or it's like, oh, I'm going to expand this existing feature, but we're not going to improve anything about the product. If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And all this does is create a foundation, in my opinion, for long-term churn for people who maybe either don't have the need long-term, or again, as they've lived with a product for a long time, they have different or new needs that pop up that this product is basically saying, we're just not even going to pretend those exist. Like, we're not going to address that at all. So then what happens? Year two, year three, that customers really, they start getting the itch a little bit because they're like, man, I really want it to do like other things, or I really want it to do this, but better. Or sometimes even this happens in the first year. They're like, man, I've lived with this product for a while now. And like, I just feel like things could be better. And they can't ever articulate how or why. This actually brings me to my next point, which is like customers can't actually tell you what to build. So that's why you need a good process. But there's like this tension that gets created because they know that something is wrong, but they don't have like words necessarily to describe it. So then they start looking. It triggers a looking process. And then they start looking. And usually what causes a customer to churn, there's something contextual for them that shifts. And it could also just be like, I'm frustrated, I'm leaving, I'm out. But a lot of the time it's like, they get promoted or they hire someone new or someone else gets hired and they have a new boss or sometimes they leave the organization. They're like, and then, you know, whoever comes up after them is like, I don't know this product. Who is this? And then maybe they start looking. So there's all kinds of things that can get triggered, but rarely do customers leave for one reason. We're going to have like a busy founder's guide to churn and like understanding retention episode at some point, but it's rarely ever one reason. Usually it's like 10 reasons. But, you know, when they cancel and they select, oh, it was missing features or I went with another competitor or like no reason. I just like things just are different now. Like they give you like one answer, but actually there are 10 answers. So you don't really know like the real reason why they left. But all that to say, like that, it triggers a looking process. And I think that's something that founders kind of forget about. So much of the focus is on marketing and on getting customers through the door. And not as much of it is focused on keeping them when they're here and making all of that investment worth it, because it's expensive as hell to get like new customers.
And I'm curious to hear about your process because, you know, it can seem like progress is being made if you have a checklist of bugs that you're
totally,
you know, you're fixing. And that feels like progress. And then to your point, if the customer isn't explicitly saying, I need this, but, you know, it's hard to know what to add to your list. So, you know, what do these founders do?
What do you do? Totally. So I recommend thinking of it one of two ways. And I think that this will work. Either of these ways works for different types of companies and teams and leadership. The first way to think about it is a sprint methodology. Sprint meaning like there's some period of time where you go ham on talking to customers and really seeing how they're using the product and really getting into the details about, okay, they're at the 2-year mark. What are they doing? And like, how are they using the product now? And you certainly can ask them the question, what do you want? But the issue with that is customers can't tell you what new value to create for them. They can only tell you what they're working with that's broken. So like asking customers what they want, they'll give you a list of quality of life improvements and they're going to give you a list of bugs. It's really, really, really hard for them to tell you value generators, which is the other category that helps prevent value decline. So value generators, they tend to be net new features or net new additions to the platform that, again, extend the value by tackling a new job to be done. So that is a value generator. It's really, really, really hard for them to tell you about value generators. You might get lucky and talk to someone who can tell you a value generator or two or several, but 80, 70% are not. Like most people can only really tell you like bugs to fix and quality of life improvements. And to get even more specific, they can't necessarily tell you, you know, here's what's wrong with the UX or here's what's wrong with the design. You have to watch them use a product to understand that. And watching them is critical, not session recordings. Like you have to actually like give them a task, get them on a 15-minute call and say, show me how you build this report, or show me how you create your schedule, or show me how you're like booking customers or whatever. Like whatever those smaller micro jobs to be done tasks are, watch them actually do it. And again, like we talked about UX before and like UX research, just asking them is not enough. Like you actually have to watch them. I would even recommend if you're serious, like serious, you would get on a plane and go to their office, go to their facility, wherever it is that they work, and watch them use a product. You will be flabbergasted at like how your product looks in their world. And you might cry, to be honest, because you're like, wow, this is not what I thought it was, because it makes sense to you, but it doesn't make sense to anybody else. Anyway, that's if you're like dead ass serious. But it's okay if you're not. That's okay. Most people do virtual, and most people don't even do that. Most people just look at screen recordings or session replays. And even then, they hardly do that. Some would rather crunch a number and assume, wildly assume what's going on. And that assumptions are never your friend in product and design world. So that is, I think, the very first baseline is to really understand like how your customers are using the product. Now, when it comes to value generators, so this is where jobs mapping and value mapping, in my opinion, is crucial. Like you really, like we do this in Miro, you really do have to map out the steps and or the phases of the job, mapping out each of the steps and really combing through. And the more customers that you talk to, the more that that map gets updated and the more that you have a very clear understanding of, okay, here are all the tasks that people have to do to accomplish their job. And then highlight where your product fits. And if you can even highlight, get specific about, oh, this specific feature they're using at this specific step. And there are going to be some tasks where they're not using it at all. There are going to be some tasks where when they're accomplishing that job, they're 100% in your product. And then the goal is really to see where can the product extend that is in alignment with your mission and vision for the product that you feel like would create financial monetary value and also, of course, real functional value for customers. That's opportunity space. I've talked about like problem space versus solution space. Really, like we're looking at like what's the opportunity. The next step would be to now solution. And I think that this is also where, like, not only do we not understand fully our opportunities in our products, I think the other issue too is sometimes we have the idea or like we're like, ooh, this is an opportunity. But what we end up designing and building is like not what a customer cares about. And this disconnect is also because we don't validate our ideas. We have another episode coming up on product and idea validation. Solutioning is hard. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say like it's super easy. I cannot tell you how many times, especially recently, I've come up with designs for something in the product that like didn't make sense. I know y'all didn't think I could design, but I can design a little bit. So there, I can't tell you how many times I'm like, oh, this makes so much sense to me. But then like I'll put it in front of someone and then I'm like, damn, they didn't get it. And then someone like way smarter than me at UX and design comes along and they're like, oh, do this and this and this. And then all of a sudden people get it. And I'm like, damn it, that is smarter. But then I'm like happy because I learn, everyone learns and the customer's happy, whatever. But I can't tell you how many times that happens. So like solutioning is hard, but part of the process has to be that we also validate our ideas. And when they're invalidated, we pivot, we adjust, we go back to the drawing board a little bit. Like we got to go back. So design thinking is a really popular concept here. I'm very much a believer in create prototypes, break things fast, and just like see, like, and actually get people to use it to learn quickly. Yeah. This type of approach is, I think it could be for everyone. Not everyone wants to move that quickly. Not everyone wants to move that strategically either. So I understand if that is not for you. I would argue, though, that it's for everyone. But I'm very much a believer in like create a working comp, like get it in people's hands as soon as possible. And it doesn't have to take 2 weeks. You don't even have to fully build the feature. You just have to get like a real comp in front of someone and get them navigating and get them like asking questions. Oh, does it do this? Does it do that? You can have concepts in your hand and like insight in as little as 2 weeks. And this is where I would say like sprint methodology to me, maybe the sprint is 4 weeks long and maybe the design sprint itself could be like 2 weeks long, but you are crunching through design and product ideas, usually combined, to validate your ideas, test your assumptions, and ultimately build something that people are actually excited to use. What I don't recommend is doing the status quo, which is making assumptions in a vacuum, building in a vacuum, and like pushing code in a vacuum. Like you are now publishing this feature and maybe you've talked to a couple customers about it. Maybe you've had a couple people use it, but you never once included them in the solution process. You didn't include them in the problem process either, or the opportunity process. We didn't validate this idea. We didn't validate how we're executing against it. Okay, great. We've identified the opportunity or we've identified the problem. But is this the right solution for that problem? And does it work across many hands, not just one or two, because that was all we had time for? And then finally, when we did actually solution it, did we validate that? with anyone? Like, did we put that in front of anyone? And now that we've published it, like there are other steps, especially for big risks that we're taking with our products. That is the best case scenario. The status quo is doing none of that, making assumptions, guessing, you know, developing and coding something and being like, this is so great, everyone's going to get it. And then like you push it and then no one gets it. A very small percentage uses it. This to me says, okay, we didn't do enough digging and understanding. We didn't really go through the process, and we definitely didn't, you know, do any type of like UX interviews or research to like see how people would use it. And then we cry later because we're like, man, product doesn't create more value. This product is a, you know, value suck. Like, it's a resource suck. It doesn't work. And it's like, actually, product is your greatest growth lever, but like, it's fine. So it's similar actually to like, oh, marketing stinks. It doesn't work. We're, you know, putting all this money into it. And it's like, well, are we doing it well? Are we doing it right? Are we putting enough energy into it and also peeling back where we shouldn't be? It's the same concept. And then, so I mentioned sprints, but the other way would be ongoing. So like having, like if you have a continuous like development motion, like you're always developing, you're always, you know, like creating, like always updating your roadmap, always thinking of features. I think most teams are continuous, but they might not actually be continuously validating or continuously exploring or continuous discovery habits is the term by Teresa Torres. I believe we got to fact check me on that. It's rare, I find, to have a team that's doing continuous discovery habits, which basically is like you have a process that is ongoing that identifies these opportunities and problems to solve. And you have a really good process for strategically defining the solution for either of those. What we typically see is most teams have a continuous solution habit, but none of the discovery and very little of the validation. Like there's very little validation happening. It's, oh, I have a whim, I'm going to build it. And like, we're just going to go and we're going to do it and see how it works. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's like beta testing or what have you, but there's very little like idea validation and also like validating it like with from like a design or UX perspective. That's more common. Continuous is, I would say, tough to do. Like it's really, and it's tough because you have to be disciplined. I find either way you have to be disciplined because even if you commit to sprints, you still have to be disciplined. But I do find it's a little bit easier to do sprints where you say, okay, once per quarter, we're going to have a discovery sprint and that is going to impact our roadmap for Q3 or whatever. So maybe you do your discovery sprint in Q1, but then you don't actually like solution and build things until Q3, giving yourself like enough time to clear out the backlog from previous quarters, basically. And then some are like, you know, we'll take a quarter to do it all. We'll, you know, 1 month will be discovery and another month will be like idea validation. And like the third month might be like, we're actually like building it and putting it into production. It really, I think, depends on your personal preference and also your team skills and capabilities and like how organized can you be and how diligent can you be about your processes? How good are you at setting operations and actually like refining your processes and following it? Both require, I think, those skills. But I do think, you know, sprints could be really good, but also continuous is really the preference. But the assumption is that you've got things pretty dialed in like operationally.
I think it's Emily Kramer who says, don't do random acts of marketing.
Yeah.
It's like, don't do random acts of product improvement.
You know? Literally, don't do random acts of product. The same. It's totally the same.
Don't just blame marketing. You know, product needs their process too.
Exactly. And I would actually argue that like, especially if you're SaaS and you're product-led growth, like product-led growth implies that you expect the most growth to come from product. And if that's the messiest in the organization, or if that's like the least, you know, on it, then your PLG motion will suffer like 100%. We just talked to a company recently. They're pretty large. They're like 5 million. Super small product and development team, which honestly, like to their credit, that's impressive as hell. No product analytics, no product validation process, no discovery, really. And all that says to me is like, oh, well, product is actually your greatest growth lever if that's the case. They have investment, like they can absolutely invest in product. Like they're not resource constrained is what I'm trying to say. They have the resources to invest. And the irony is they're thinking of giving it all to marketing. And I'm like, whoa, like, yes, let's give some to marketing. Don't get me wrong. Like, but that needs to, a lot of that needs to go to product. Mm-hmm. Like product needs resources. We can't conquer the world if we've got like a couple of sticks and some mayonnaise. Like, come on. But anyway, I very much believe in balance across the whole organization. But what's interesting is the more companies we talk to, it's fascinating because what you find is incredible growth comes from balance across all of the growth levers. But what you end up finding is there's like all of the eggs are placed into one basket and it's usually acquisition. And so much of my job is being like, no, we got to take other eggs and put them. And if you actually have money for more eggs, like let's do that too. Like maybe we don't take a bunch of eggs away from acquisition, but like customer acquisition specifically. But if this is all we have, let's spread this out a little bit because it's not all going to come from acquisition. That's probably your worst growth lever, actually. And that's the thing that I obviously fly the flag the most on. I'm sure, as you know, Kim.
Yes.
And hopefully everyone listening.
Hope you all are listening too.
I feel like I hit the points that I wanted to hit, but I think my ultimate message is just to remember that customers just cannot tell you what to build. Sometimes you get lucky, but most of the time, again, they can only tell you bugs and quality of life improvements. And even then, they can't necessarily tell you design and UX problems, but they can tell you like, oh yeah, this filter doesn't work when I like click it, or like, it'd be really cool if I could filter the report by this. Oh yes, by date? Duh. Why didn't I think of that? Yeah, absolutely. Let's add that to the list. Like that's a quality of life improvement.
Right.
But it's rare that they're going to be like, you know what? I need invoicing, or I need payroll, or it'd be really cool like if you could integrate with my bank. Like sometimes that's really hard. Like some customers don't always think, because their whole thing is like 90% of customers. No, there's the select 10% that's very vocal. They know what their needs are and they will tell you nonstop. They're the very loud few, I will say. But 90% of people are like, they're not actually, either they don't think that you're serious that you're going to build it, or they just can't conceive. They're not product people. They can't conceive of you deciding to like acquire a whole new company to provide services that they didn't have before. Like that's, if that were the case, they'd be CEOs, right?
Right.
Or VPs of product, but they're not usually. Right. Now I do think there are some SaaS companies that do get lucky. Like imagine Notion, for example. Notion, who originally was created for product people, if I'm not mistaken, I bet Notion gets tons of feedback because their audience are product people.
Right.
And I bet that there are scenarios in SaaS companies where like, it's kind of, what's the word? It's very Ouroboros-like, where it's like, it's interweaved and a little bit like self-fulfilling as a prophecy. But that's like 2% of companies, probably less than that. Most of y'all are not in industries like that, where your customer is going to be able to tell you what to build. 99%, actually, I would guarantee.
Yeah. So it's a good message. Don't wait for your customer to give you the ideas. Build a process around it.
It's got to be discovery. We have to have a discovery process. And then we have to validate our ideas. Otherwise, you know, you're susceptible to value decline. And again, if you're stuck at that like 70% NRR mark, there's a solid chance that you're experiencing value decline. It could also be your pricing, but that's a whole other podcast that we already have. Yes. We're basically like, our pricing is not optimized enough to create expansion revenue. And that's why we're stuck at like 70%. But I digress. A lot of it tends to be like long-term sneaky churn. And that NRR, it does not lie. It doesn't lie. She's a tough metric. But if you can make it 100% in 12 months, life is usually a lot easier. And you're like, man, growth is great. And that's typically what we hear from founders that have that.
Yep.
Okay, I'm done preaching. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Kim, as per usual.
Thanks, Asia.
All right, bye, y'all.